My name is Dan Lewis, and this is the first session on crime and justice this week.
Where are you from?
Northwestern University, just outside of Chicago. One way to begin a discussion about crime and general justice is to think through what the crime problem really is. And although that may seem self-evident, lots of people define it very differently. And one way we can get at how you all define it, and each of you define it, is to look at what I call the justice funnel to see what happens as we move from an actual victimization, when something happens to somebody, to the ultimate punishment, which would be to go to prison. And as you see from what happens up here, for every robbery, for every burglary that takes place, only 27 and 29% of them ever get reported to the police. So one of the interesting things that we're dealing with from the very beginning, when we try to think about crime and think about justice, is that two-thirds of these incidents never get phoned in. Now, there are lots of reasons, and we can think of them fairly easily in our head for why that might be. One is, it might not have been serious enough. Yeah.
Dan, 87,000 robberies, they're not phoned in. How do they know?
One of the things that's been developed in the last 15 years, one of the things that I work with in my work, are what are called victimization studies. And what these do is they are surveys of huge numbers of people in the population every year. And you're surveyed over the phone, and they say to you, in the last 6 months, has this kind of thing happened to you? Mm-hmm. Okay? So you can get, up until we had that, we were totally reliant on the police for all of our information on crime. And as you all, I'm sure in each of your cities and towns realize, the police obviously don't hear about all those things. And in their way of categorizing and organizing their material, don't show them, show the actual activities in as objective a light as we'd like. So when the FBI talks about its statistics, and that's what you usually hear on the radio and the TV, those are reported crimes the police are telling you about. These victimization studies, that's why I have victim up here, give you an estimate of the total amount of crime that isn't reliant on the police department to get the picture. So the fact that only about a third of these crimes ever get reported is in itself a tremendously significant event. Because if it doesn't get to the police, there's nothing that the society can really do about the problem. And there are lots of reasons why it doesn't. I mean, sometimes, I remember the other day I was coming home from Michigan, and I couldn't find some money in my pocket. And I got home, and I woke up the next morning, and I thought I had $80 in my pocket, and it wasn't there. Now, I didn't report it to the police, because, well, maybe I lost it, or it slipped out of my pocket when I was getting out of the car. Or maybe somebody came into our cottage and took the money, and I just didn't recognize it until. So that doesn't get reported. Sometimes people are scared and they don't report them. Sometimes so much time has gone by, we're all at Holden. Some of us will go home and the soap will be gone. Now, is it worse?
Thank you, Dan.
Everybody worked into a frenzy by Wednesday.
Oh, I did.
Okay. From the founded incidents, we move to the arrest. And you can see here that we're already down to 6%, meaning of the total number of these victimizations that took place, only 6 and 5% end up in arrest. So that here we have a drop from 27 to 6%, so we're dropping by about a quarter the number of crimes that turn into us doing something about it by arresting somebody. Again, it cuts in half in terms of people going to court. And what that means is between the arrest and the person actually going to court, The prosecutor decides, for example, he doesn't have enough evidence. Or they arrested the wrong guy. Or the person, I mean, one of the interesting things about things like robberies and lots of felonies is that they happen between people that know each other. So after a while, the brother will say, well, that's not worth it. I don't want to prosecute my brother. I'll drop the charges. So they don't want to be a witness. So only 3% end up with somebody going to court. And ultimately, the ultimate punishment is going to prison. And in both cases, you're down to 1% of the original 100% that end up with somebody going to prison. So when we look at what the crime problem is, we can look in lots of these places or in between them to think about what it is that we're concerned about. Some people start up here and they say the real crime problem, is that there's so much of this stuff. And what we really ought to be doing is worrying about how we're raising our kids, the kinds of values that they have, the amount of resources and quality that there is in society, so that they can, so they won't have to resort to burglaries and robberies. The real crime problem is in the nature of what makes somebody become a criminal. And that's where we ought to be putting our time. Other people look at this statistic. They say the real crime problem is that the citizens don't care. They aren't concerned enough, they don't care enough to actually, to even pick up the phone and call in the criminal with that, much less go to court, much less be serious about doing something to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Some people look at the police. They say the crime problem is the police department. They aren't arresting enough people, they don't have enough money, they need to be better organized so that they do a better job of arresting people. The average policeman in the United States makes one arrest a year. Some say it's the courts. This is, now we're getting into familiar territory, right? The prosecutors don't prosecute, they're not serious about going after people, they only prosecute the ones they're sure of, so forth and so on. And finally, some say it's the judges. If only the judges were stricter, if only more people went to prison, we'd be in a better situation.
Well, Dan, what do you think about these judges that in Chicago that were on the tape? And everybody knew about it, including the lawyers.
Right. No, that's right.
You don't have confidence then,
What I'm trying to point out to you is that there are lots of different ways. One of the reasons this has been a tough issue for this society to handle is everybody can point to a different spot and say, let's start here. Let's start with the judges. Let's start with the amount of inequality in society. Let's start with character, personal attributes. It's really a matter of a kid's brought up right. He's not going to be fooling around with this stuff. The average burglar is 16 years old. We're not talking about the crafty professional. We're talking about 16-year-old kids, half of whom have stopped burglaring by the time they're 20. So there are lots of different places to begin when you want to think about what the crime problem is. There are a couple things that I'd like to point out about this. We're only sending 1% to prison. If we tripled our efforts, spent triple the money, had triple the manpower on the streets, had much tougher laws, we only get it up to 3%.
Or maybe there were still more prisons.
Yeah.
But there were already close.
So where you start in thinking about the crime problem will pivot on lots of, will determine to a large extent where you end up. If you start here, you'll build more prisons. You'll ask for tougher judges. You'll ask for stiffer penalties. And that's what we've done. If you start here, lots of people think about prevention. They start thinking about, what can we do so that adolescents don't turn to crime? How can we make a difference in terms of that? If you start here at arrest, then you'll be calling for more police, more protection, more surveillance, more manpower out on the streets. But so much, you know, if you want to draw a line, so much of the problem disappears by the time you get into the criminal justice system. That is to say, by the time somebody's called the cops, made the effort to call the cops, and the police have picked somebody up, you're only down to an infinitesimally small percentage of the crime problem out in society. So the criminal justice system, which is who we give the responsibility for handling us, wants to load up in terms of the solving the problem on this end, more arrests, better courtrooms, more prisons in order to deal with the problem. But a huge percentage of the problem is up here.
Is that a true cross-section all the way down, or are there more serious crimes at the bottom?
Well, that's a good question, because that's one of the things we hope was the case. That is to say, by the time you get to the 1%, is this the guy that's pulled, you know, 100 robberies in the society? Is this the guy that's the professional burglar, that if you put him away, we're going to do some good? The answer is we don't know. We don't know from a research standpoint, because each one of these systems, from the victimization surveys that are done by the federal government to the state prisons down here, runs a separate system of statistics, doesn't share its information as it wants, keeps it a different way than the others keep it, is very proprietary about who it shares it with and how it shares it. We hope, like as the gentleman's alluded, we hope that this is the worst guy. But the thing that makes us nervous about being sure that it's the worst guy is how these decisions at the other points are made. They're not made when you don't call the police. You're not calling the police because you're usually, because you say, well, it's just a kid, I'll forget about it. You're often not calling the police because you're scared, or it's too late. Or sometimes it was a minor event. But even if it was a minor event, that doesn't mean the guy's a minor player as a criminal. The arrests, if the police don't hear about the crime almost as it's happening, that is to say, that there's a crime in progress and somebody calls, it's terribly hard for them to make an arrest. Because once the crime's over and 3 or 4 minutes have passed, it's very hard to identify who the guy was. So unless they're lucky and see it happening on the street, or somebody, you know, wakes up and hears something downstairs and picks up the phone and they get over there real fast, it's very hard to make an arrest. So who's arrested may or may not be the worst character out there. Maybe the unluckiest character out there. The court business is the same kind of thing. When a prosecutor decides not to charge somebody or go to court, he's not making that decision by and large on the basis of that being sort of a lightweight customer, therefore it's not worth the effort. He's making the judgment on the basis of whether the witness is still around, of whether the evidence is any good. Again, it may or may not be the worst character who's caught in this vice, but if the witness doesn't show up, he can't prosecute, and it may be the worst guy in town, and often it is. Finally, when you get to prison, this is probably the saddest part. The guy that ends up, one of the things that's a little deceptive about this figure is that this 3% here and 2% here, this other percentage, is often on probation. Over here. So that almost everybody that goes to court, as Vern and some of the rest of you know, gets found guilty. I mean, one of the things the prosecutor is doing is making a judgment about whether he can convict the person. So almost everybody that goes to court gets some kind of sentence, but that prosecutor's judgment about that is going to, I mean, sometimes it'll be weighed by this guy's really a bad egg, let's go after him. But he doesn't want to lose. He doesn't want to waste the judge's time. he doesn't want to waste the court's time in terms of prosecuting somebody he can't win on, because everybody comes up to him afterwards and says, come on, Ralph. So let's go after the ones we can win, because those, that's a good use of our time. So the guy that ends up in prison may or may not be the worst guy on the block. My gut feeling is that, and that's one of the reasons, I was going to call it a, what do you call those games, like a pinball game, but it's too long a word to put up there. My feeling about it is that it's really a pinball game. And the chance of going blah, 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 and ending down at the bottom is not because you're the worst guy on the block, but perhaps you're the unluckiest. Now, of course, there are, you know, terrible, we were talking about Bundy a little bit last night, there are terrible characters out there that we do catch, and often with murders, which is one of the most feared crimes of all. Of course, lots of those people do get caught, mostly because they don't run away. Acting a fit of passion, and they sort of put down the gun and call the police themselves, or just sit there. That kind of person may very well end up in prison. But the robbers and the burglars and the armed robbers and the kind of vicious street punk that we're all so worried about, we call them in the business predatory offenders. These guys that over and over again have no sense of conscience, just go out and continue to do this kind of stuff. I just don't know whether they're in this figure or not. And I worry that they're not, because the judgments that people are making all along here in terms of what they're excluding is not based on the character of the offender. It's based on the character of the situation in the organization where he has to make the decision. So, that's
and it.
Yeah.
Are some of the 6% lost in your statistical sense, by the police or the prosecutor's office accepting restitution and never charging that kind of thing?
Not in these figures. These figures, these are all estimates that we did in Chicago, and they're rough. But these figures include juvenile court as well as regular felony adult court. So anybody that gets pursued is in. Yeah.
Reveal my ignorance. What's the difference in robbery and burglary with weapons with robbery?
Right. A robbery is when you take some valuables away from somebody face to face with the threat.
Well, to me, it seems like I could see not reporting a burglary because there isn't that much evidence, probably, in most cases that you have to. But a robbery, it just seems like that's so much greater.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
That's unbelievable. There wouldn't be a higher, the difference wouldn't be greater between the two crimes because the robbery is so much more serious crime.
Well, one thing to keep in mind when you're thinking about it is these kinds of concepts, robbery and burglary, we're used to thinking of them as sort of events in the world, but they're in fact categories of decisions that people are making about events. I mean, one of my favorite kinds of examples here is there are two friends fighting over radio. And he says, it's my radio, so I can have it this week. He said, what are you talking about? It's not your radio. It's my radio. I paid for it. They fight. One of them grabs the radio over away from the other one and punches him in the mouth. And he walks home. The other guy gets pissed and calls the cops and says, that guy took my radio. Well, that's a robbery, as well as assault and battery. And lots of events in here that we call robberies because they have certain characteristics are conflicts between people that end up with somebody calling the police and saying, do something about that. Some of it, of course, is on the street late at night, you're walking along, and a stranger comes up, sticks a gun in your ribs and says, give me your money, and the wise person, you hand it over and hope for the best. But a lot of it has to do with these other kinds of conflict. Another useful thing to remember here is lots of people aren't crazy about the police. We're comfortable with the police and we depend on them and we see them as protectors. But the lower you go down the socioeconomic ladder, the more questionable that is. People depend on the police a lot in poor communities. But they're very dubious about it. And getting involved with the police can be a real hassle. And if you don't think they can do anything about getting the money back, I'll give you another, got myself into trouble. If you don't have confidence that calling the police will do something for you, and it may hurt you, you may not do it. The third thing that's in here is lots of kids. The most victimized group in our society in terms of violent crime are young males, 16 to 24. That's who's getting hit on the head and getting their stuff taken from them the most often. And it's usually poor young males. That group is a little macho. And if you get your money taken from, you know, I know who that guy was, and I'm going to get that guy. And the police isn't a part of it. It's something that you're going to handle yourself. So there are lots of things like that that go into this picture. The point, before I open this up for some more discussion, one thing I want to leave you with that we'll get back to tomorrow and the next day is, most of the discussion takes place below this line. Most of the discussion is the corrections and the courts and the police department arguing about getting more resources in order to do a better job. But even if we double or triple them, you're just making a dent in the total amount that's up here. Now, when I say what my answer to what the crime problem is, has a lot to do with looking above this line. But that's, you know, just my two cents. And what the purpose of the session is today is to talk some about what your notion of the crime problem is, and kind of using this maybe as a starting ground for describing why it is that you think where you want to start is the place to start. Lots of people start at the bottom. So with that, I'll be quiet.
All right, I've got a question that's down. I wanted to ask before it came here. It seems like it went off the bat. This policy of scared straight was enacted a few years ago in a few areas. Whatever happened to something like that, and why are we not hearing about it or seeing it, or what's happened?
Well, the reason we're not hearing about it and seeing about it is it didn't work out very well. Oh, I'm sorry.
I know that we had, when I was in the service, I know they had one in Denver, I believe. I don't remember what city I was in. I did a lot of traveling where they took a group of teenagers and they, the police and court systems set this up where there was counseling beforehand a little bit, as I remember correctly. Then they brought the kids through the prisons and showed them these hardened criminals and ways the crimes and what type of people these were beforehand. I'm going second nature here from other people. And I know of at least two kids that I talked to after that were so frightened out of their gourds that they wouldn't even so much as pick up a match off the street, let alone think of making it.
The convicts talk about how terrible it is in prison and what the consequences are of. And again, that sort of fits what we were talking about, because that's a kind of below the line thing where it seems like it would make a lot of sense. And I think what happens is you do get scared straight for a couple of weeks, and then you're back.
You're not going to get caught.
Yeah, you're not going to get caught.
It's not going to happen to you.
And you're back with your friends and. Yeah, I think it probably just wears off. And there were some studies of it, and I think that's what they showed. Did you have a? No.
Do you have some clues to what kind of prevention is, I know it's hard to document or do evaluation of prevention, but do you have some clues to what might work?
I have some things I want to talk about as we go along in the week about that. We alluded to a couple of them last night. I think one of the things that's so important is what's going on up here, both on the offender side and on the victim side. And I'm much more interested in my own work in trying to think about how we can work with this figure and the factors that produce it. It takes two to tango on a robbery, right? You have to be in the wrong place, the offender has to be in the wrong place, and the situation has to allow for him to do the bad thing to you. And that leaves you three, as we say in the business, variables, three aspects of the situation that you can work with. You can get the person not to be there. You can get the person that the offender not to want to do that to you. And you can make the situation such is that they couldn't do it even if they wanted to.
That's kind of a utopian picture. You can't get everybody to do exactly what you want to do.
That's right. That's right. I don't think in any situation these things are going to be done away with in the near future. I mean, there's just too many people that A, aren't socialized in terms of the kinds of middle class values that we have, and B, don't have things and have no way of getting things other than doing it illegitimately to make it totally disappear. But I'm not interested in disappearing. I'm interested in getting these numbers down.
All right, have you seen anything, do you have neighborhood watch in Chicago?
Yeah.
Do you think that plays into the role here? Have you seen it in a period of years, statistic-wise, changing any of those figures?
We did a big study of it a couple of years ago, and there, you know, it's mixed. The community group's got to go do it after they sure. say they're going to do it, and they have to try to do it well. But there, in some of the neighborhoods, it did have an effect. There were reductions in crime, and people did feel better. But it's not a, you know, it takes work.
Have there been any restitution to victims kinds of programs?
Yeah, that's a good question. There have. I'm not real familiar with how well they've worked. It makes sense. I mean, logically, it seems to make sense. But again, you got to catch the kid. I mean, you've got to get somebody there who will do the restitution.
And that's a sentence to the guilty person clear down the bottom of your chair.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And that's we're only arresting 6%. We're only finding 6% of the people that we think did it, and they may not. I mean, they are innocent until proven guilty. I mean, they might not have done it, but the cops only found 6% of the total, and that's what's so. I mean, that it's utopian in a way, but that's also what makes your imagination start to work. We're used to depending on the criminal justice system to solve this for us in our neighborhood. You know, you call the police, it's somebody else's problem. And what we're saying when we start to think about above that line is maybe it's our problem. And maybe there are some things we can do, especially in tandem with the cops and the prosecutors, that can do some good. Yeah.
Well, and also the incarceration, the actual 1%, is a punishment, but as far as a deterrent to crime, it's pretty well proven that those high percentage of those would be, it's like going to graduate school for some of them. They just kind of further their talents in terms of crime.
It's pretty dreary. I mean, within a year of release, well over half of them are probably going to be back. And within five, it's even higher than that. So. You know, I mean, I think if you want to start down there, you have to be a person that's interested in punishment. I mean, basically interested in punishment. And there's nothing wrong with that. You just have to take the consequences of it, which you do punish, but it may not do much to improve the character of that person. And also lots of these people that end up in prison don't see it as part of their lives. I mean, spending some time in prison is as natural to them as spending some time in graduate school or undergraduate school for some of us. Something that you do. No.
What's it cost to keep a man in prison, Dan? Do you know offhand?
About $25,000 a year.
What if we just gave him $25,000? He'd be a good boy.
Well, some of them aren't going to be good boys. I think that's the. But I mean, you know, you're getting at exactly why this is such a tough issue.
Yeah.
Have you been able to pinpoint any variables as to, you said it, most robberies occur by 16 to 20-year-olds?
Burglaries, yeah.
Burglaries. Have you been able to pinpoint any reasons why that age group and any factors that, you know, is it a lark?
Some of it.
Is it a depressing home life? Is it, you know,
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think your guess is as good as mine on that. I think about myself at 16, and we were constantly going places we weren't supposed to be going. You know, I was mentioning to a friend of mine about how we were always trying to get back into school for some reason, you know, to play basketball or, you know, it seems odd now that, I mean, we didn't like school that much, but we were always sneaking back onto the playground or, you know, into the gym or something like that. You know, that's, I think, part of sort of growing up and being adventurous and taking risks and doing things you're not supposed to see what's going to happen.
Yes, with the advent of the drug problem in the last 10 years, really a lot worse than ever, has that had a marked effect on the burglary?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, I could hazard a guess just like you could. I suspect it has had an appreciable effect on, you know, on that portion of the burglars who have serious drug habits that they have to feed. One of the interesting things about the research in the area is that we're assuming that people that take drugs do burglaries, but it's also the case that burglars take drugs, and sometimes the burglary came ahead of the drug, so it's a complicated set of factors that go into it. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who, in order to get the money to pay for the drugs, break into people's houses, but there are lots of people that break into people's houses who also take drugs, and then you get into this kind of complicated mixture of things.
You know, listening to the whole kind of overview here makes me think of my own neighborhood in Portland, and I know that we have the neighborhood watch, and I know that wherever you don't have a neighborhood watch, that's where they kind of gravitate to. Mm-hmm. And but you can't have a neighborhood watch effectively done every place, and that's kind of compounded by some people have burglar alarms, others don't. Some people have screens on their windows and bars on their windows and their doors and so on. Others don't. And the ones that don't are the ones that get hit.
Exactly right.
And the ones that, and then there's other things too, and I was, you think about the economy which we live in now, and the fact that a lot of social monies are no longer available because of the budget being cut back and a lot of things that provide more people who, by necessity, fall into crime. They don't get that free meal ticket anymore. They don't have the opportunity to go away and work someplace on a, let's say, a CETA, or a government-funded program. We're relying on the private individual and the private business to provide for society's needs, and it's not working out. That's the Reagan way of doing it, you know. You say, let's rely on the people, let's rely on the industry and so on. And it really doesn't work. I think we get more crime now than we did before when we were having a lot of social programs. I'm not saying that's the answer. But on top of all that, when you do find that a lot of these people get picked up because they're unfortunates, because they're minority groups, they're the ones that get arrested, they're the ones that get convicted, they're the ones that get put away, the ones that have the money to fight the battles and get out of going to jail, or the ones that continue to commit crimes. And so it seems like all around, everything that we do is contributing to the problem that we have. It's not making it better, it's making it worse.
You know, it's, I don't want to speak for a conservative mentality, but let me try a little bit. I mean, I think the answer is, I mean, the answer that a conservative would give back to you is that those programs didn't do much good, and that what they do is they reward people for poor behavior and bad behavior. They give them jobs when they don't want to work. They, and that, you know, what the current system does, at least it incapacitates that guy for the time that he's in jail. And, I mean, the whole of the argument is that it's not too likely he's going to end up in jail. But at least we're sending a message that there are going to be tougher penalties and you're going to serve the time, and there's no making you into a hero or calling you underprivileged, and you're gonna have to suffer the consequences of your activities. And they, you know, the conservative would say back that the other stuff, we spent a lot of money on the other stuff, and they would argue that that didn't do much good. You know, I don't know what the answer is.
Dan, those statistics are for 1980, I think.
83, I think.
83?
Yeah, and it's just Chicago. I mean, I think you'd find this in any town. I mean, you know, when you get into smaller towns, your prosecutors are countywide. Actually, it's in Chicago, too. I mean, but this kind of sifting happens every place just because of the bulk that they have to deal with, and the limitations that are placed on the different organizations. You know, policemen are limited in what they can do. They ride around in these cars 8 hours a day, and somebody pretty much got to call in for them to go into action. And you only call in after the bad thing has happened. You know, I mean, once in a while it's happening. City of Chicago gets 3 million calls to the police department every year. 3 million. That's one for everybody in town. And 90% of them are, as a cat up in a tree, I lost the keys to my car. You know, sometimes they're serious things. You know, somebody's had a heart attack or they've called the wrong place. I mean, a huge amount of what the police are about is serving, is dealing with situations that we don't know who else to turn with to, and that takes up a tremendous amount of their time.
Perhaps one of the problems is that, I thought of it when you said people are trying to meet their needs by going out and robbing and burglarizing. And maybe that's one of the places that we could look is in defining what are our needs. And perhaps we are too materialistic in that we are teaching our young people that they need a DCR. And there's various things that are now in the category of need. And that category is always increasing. The number of things that are necessities are always increasing. Perhaps that's one of the reasons that people are out there stealing.
The best predictor, that's the thing that we is most often associated with being the victim of a violent crime, is being very poor. The poorer you are, the more likely you're going to be a victim. So the irony of the situation is that going after the VCR and the material stuff, they're picking on the poorest members of the society who had the least to spare, but are often the person next door. Yeah.
Well, I know it's real complicated, but it just seems like going back to basics is partially the breakdown of the family. Mm-hmm. In the, you know, in the United States, the high divorce rate, the, you know, just lack of mom being home and driving. Mm-hmm. There could be a case made for a lot of that. The original upbringing, that's where you got to go back and really.
You know, one of the reasons for putting this on the board is to show you, I think, my intention, is to show you that the data doesn't have the answer. The answer's in the value system you bring to the data. Because there's no right or wrong place to start on it. There's just this place to start that makes the most sense to you. And that makes the most sense based on the kind of value system that you're operating with. Some people start with inequality, and some people start with character. I mean, you're basically making a pitch for character, which is an absolutely
reasonable place to start. And then the question is, how do you think through what you do to change these things? Because our society, pretty much, you know, the door to the family is not a door that's open to much state intrusion, even for the best reasons. So how you get somebody to raise that kid differently and to think differently about what they're doing, that's a plenty tall order. I'm not saying it can't be done.
Well, there's one thing seems to me that can be done. Instead of giving the mother money so that she can stay home and raise her own children, they train her for a job so that she can become self-respecting and then pay for good daycare centers for the children so that they can get some other value system. This perpetuates itself because they're all their role models live in a certain way, so that's the way they live too.
One of the interesting positive things about the Reagan revolution, as we call it in the educational biz, is that it's gotten, conservative scholars focus on the kind of issues we're talking about, and in focusing on it, in particular the black family, it's illuminated an area that everybody has been scared of talking about for the 20 years before. I mean, liberals, and I count myself as one, didn't want to say that person is different from me. That person has a different value system. That person treats their kids differently than me. The conservatives, to their credit, were able to stand up and say, wait a minute, let's look at this situation. There is an underclass. That underclass is composed of people that have a different value system, which is destructive not only to the people outside of it, but to that, to those people themselves. And it's different than other ones. And there has been more attention in the last 5 or 6 years to these issues. Now, there's also been attention within the black community itself to these issues too, and that's really probably the most important thing, because it's going to be very hard for somebody, you know, from outside of that community to be telling those people how to live and raise their kids and so forth. But if the black community itself starts to think about these issues and be more in tune with how children are being raised and what kinds of values are being they're being socialized with, there's potentially a chance to change it. You know, it's something that, I mean, I don't want to blame the liberals for everything, but, you know, big public housing projects and AFDC and all the things that were done for all the best intentions may have created this, and changes in our economy where there's not much interest in unskilled labor anymore than there was 25 or 30 years ago, has put a ceiling and made a sort of separate, dependent community out of lots of parts of our big cities. And that's another good place to start. Yeah.
One question that I have, and I suppose it kind of fits into this class structure, and I'm not sure if you have any statistics, but how does the, what you have there on what compare with white collar crime, like death, like, and that kind of thing,
yeah,
that we do, you know, associate more with the class?
Right. Well, it's nowhere near the magnitude. I mean, in terms of, I mean, who knows what's actually going on in the corporations? We don't have victimization studies that will allow us to tap in and find out how much embezzlement and fraud and so forth is going on. Every once in a while, the federal government tips its hat to white-collar crime. And in Chicago, we've been putting our judges away at a fast clip for a while. It comes and goes, and I think the reason it comes and goes is that people really aren't as concerned about it as they are about the street crime kinds of things. Yeah.
Your burglary there probably doesn't include the employee's theft of stuff from the places they work.
Right.
I have a hunch that's pretty huge. And that makes me think that it's a clue to one of the ways to control, and that is to control the environment in which the crime happens.
Right. And that's when I was talking about the three pieces of of looking at victimization, one of the ones that's where we had some luck is in changing that, those environments. And there are controls in a business you could put on people's comings and goings and regulate them more. That would, I'm sure, have an effect.
Well, I know I came in kind of late. Did you propose some specific ways to address that, or do you have some to suggest about how to fix
the... Not on the first day of the... I have to have a punchline at the end. So, what's the crime problem? What is it? Well, you got to start someplace.
Education?
Yeah.
Keep them in school? No dropouts?
No.
No?
You have to see the school's relevant. Just keeping them there physically.
No. Well, let me...
I've got a real good point here. I've got a problem with my own personal life. I shouldn't bear it out here, but because it's become so evident in the last month of reading it for accident. The two biggest problems I have at home right now are the fact that my daughter's peer group pressures have just blown her away. She's, of course, it has a lot to do with the fact that she associates with these types of people that are problem children. One of her best friends is allowed to just run free as she does what pleases. Eats whatever she wants, and does what she wants to, whenever, there's no babysitter. She is 10 years old. Now, I don't agree with that. And I shouldn't go and try to tell everybody else how to run their life, because I haven't had a problem with my own, but I don't know how to be a good parent myself, so I'm going to go to a counselor and find that out. But it still doesn't depreciate or appreciate the friends or peers or people around my daughter who are having problems with. This little gal, as a matter of fact, has gotten this real bad problem streets already at 10. And I feel that this has a lot to do with the fact that mom and dad can still give her a rip. Especially the fact there's no babysitter around, and I feel that babysitter is the answer, but it still restricts a child from where they can't just get freedom done. You can't go down to the store and buy candy every other day and turn it into a gun club 10 and 11. Right now, I'm really having a real tough time. But so-and-so was able to do it. I'm sorry that she has different values, she has different parents. But wait a minute, she can do it, why can't I do the thing? Now, I'm finding out that's a big bite out of the children's attitude when I see this in other kids. I've got friends who are in the same boat. And I think that John, you've had the same problem with some of Christine or Catherine's friends doing the same thing, and I've heard this over and over again. So it isn't the school's fault particularly, and it isn't the parents' fault particularly, but I think it's both that should be taken into consideration. Hey, if we don't start turning around here, giving some values to our kids when they're 5 and 6 years old, by the time they're 10, they're in trouble.
There's two things about that. One is that, and I think it's becoming more prevalent now, and that is they're making parents really responsible for what their kids do. The laws are becoming a little more strong about that, and at least in Portland, I don't know about other places, but now if a kid is arrested for something, very, very often the parent who made the paper would have done, they damaged something, destroyed something. It's up to the parent to make sure that restitution is made if they have to do it themselves. I mean, that's happening more and more in the courts now, I think. But, and the other thing is that I think that maybe this is a little flippant, but I think that your militaristic governments, your communist, your fascist governments, have got something good about them, and that is, I keep thinking back to the Hitler days, and this terrible, awful monstrosity you think about, but I don't really think they had an awful lot of crime, per se, because everybody had to carry papers wherever they went. They had to show their papers. They had to prove why they were going where they were going, and they had, every time somebody passed by a policeman, you had to show your papers. Why are you here? Oh, you're not here? You're not supposed to be here? And I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that
is awful.
I know it's awful. And I'm not saying that, I repeat, that's not right. I'm just saying that to give people as much freedom as we have and then to not tell them how to handle their freedom and then not make the parents responsible for what freedom their kids take, particularly when they infringe upon the freedoms of other people. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying that it's we opened Pandora's box by giving everybody carte blanche to do everything they wanted.
Well,
with no limitations.
Isn't parental responsibility his responsibility? You know, why pass the parental responsibility to the government? Should a mom and dad say, hey, kid, this is what we want you to do?
Yeah, but you gotta make the parent do that.
Well,
the government has
got to
make the parent do that.
I used to study alcoholism, and I know there are certain cultures in which you can find different trends in control. I wondered if there's something like that in the rearing of children or the incidence and prevalence of crime, burglary, and so forth. For instance, are there certain cultural parenting patterns where there was less incidence and prevalence? Mormons who have a high Boy Scouts and dancing, less incidents of the
church. Well, the thing I thought you were saying, the country that is often pointed to with a tremendously low crime rate is Japan, that has, which is just as industrialized, just as much of a competitive economic system as we do, but has a traditional value system which keeps the crime rate very, very, very low compared to this kind of thing. And, that's, I don't know how do you change a culture?
That's been changed, too.
Yeah, it is changing.
Japan, in the past 10 years, has had more crime than they've had in the past 1,000 years.
But it's nothing like this. I mean, even where they're going up, it's...
They're picking up too many of our values.
Well, I mean, an emphasis on freedom and an emphasis on individualism, where I don't get to tell you what to do and you don't get to tell me what to do and that's how we get along, is going to allow for that kid to have that bad influence on the other kid. And the question is, what's the balance? How much of this are we willing to put up with? One answer to the crime problem is that we really don't have one because we really don't want to do anything. We'll buy the burglar alarms and we'll move to the nicer neighborhoods and we'll go at the people that do it. But in fact, we accept it. And we accept it because the positive side of freedom and individualism is so important to us that we're willing to have this cost. And that maybe we don't have a crime problem at all because we're not willing to do much about it when you get to these fundamental kind of issues.
I worked in the inner city 6 years in Minneapolis with high school kids. And one thing that was surprising to me when my kids got picked up for shoplifting and for dealing drugs and stuff was they said that it wasn't that they needed whatever they were dealing for or lifting, but it was a sense of adventure. To see if they could get away with it. It was a form of entertainment to do what they were doing. It wasn't, we talk about what they need. And I think if you're a user, then you probably need to keep your habit going. But for my kids that were dealers, it was an adventure. It was exciting. It was as much fun to plan the beer party as it was to go to it because of all the excitement that was building and kids are looking to be entertained these days.
One of the interesting things about thinking about this is that since so little is going on below the line. Something's got to be going on above the line that gets people to stop. Because I suspect, I'm going to speak for myself, you know, I did things that were bad when I was a teenager. I didn't hold anybody up. But I stopped, you know. I got older, and I stopped. And there's something that's going on here that's stopping people because we don't have lots of 40-year-old burglars, and we don't have lots of 40-year-old robbers. So there's some mechanism where some of that stuff goes on with a kid, and they stop. They get, you know, they get caught, they get scared, some of their friend gets caught, they just, it's not fun anymore. So there are dynamics in the society that cut it off. The creepy question, and maybe something that we'll talk about as we go along, is when the criminal justice system does catch hold, you know, I mean, that 10-year-old does get caught and does have something happen to them, is that going to be something that's going to stimulate more criminality, or is that going to be something that's going to reduce criminality? Do we have a capacity through these organizations below this line to really change people, or does it harden them into a situation and a character where they stick to and that criminal activity, and they have less of a way out of it because everybody's defining them that way now, and their options once they've got a record and once that 10-year-old kid is defined sort of formally as a real troublemaker, she may be lost. I mean, she may be the one that goes down the SIP. So there's a real question about whether this apparatus assists us in reducing the crime problem or in some way helps to produce it by isolating, identifying, and categorizing people in ways where they can't get back in. Now, I don't say that that's the case, but there are certainly others that are worried about that. So we have to be careful. You know, as soon as these professional organizations start operating, we got to be, start to wonder what kind of effects they're going to have. I think maybe we better stop now. Next time I'll talk about the police, then we'll talk about the prisons some, and then finally we'll sum up on the last day and figure out what the crime problem is.
I would venture to say that we should deal with the problem above the line of the gospel of Jesus.